I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith and Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars and this week attempt to answer some of your emails.
I think I've already exceeded my caffeine for today, and it's 11 o'clock. I've gone a bit heavy on the coffee, and it's that combination of feeling sort of euphoric but also a little bit twitchy. I don't know if I like it. I'm drinking out of one of my own mugs that I sell on my own e-shop as well, though.
Just this all just a builder? promote your own mugs?
I thought I'd go in heavy.
Oh, I have had quite a lot of coffee. What do you drink coffee out of, Johnny? Did you just cup it in your hands like a caveman? No, Rich. No, I use a mug. What kind of mug?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Richard, because...
Is it?
Yeah. It's one of my own car pervert mugs that sold in my own e-shop.
Goodness me, what a lovely Christmas present for a friend or family or yourself, even.
That's a fantastic thought. I hadn't even thought of that. I hadn't even crossed my mind. It could be good for a workshop-related present.
Oh, how marvellous. The thing is, unfortunately, Johnny, I don't drink coffee from a mug. I consume coffee by soaking it into a t-shirt and then sucking it out again. I don't suppose you sell any t-shirts, do you?
It's funny you should say that. I do actually sell t-shirts.
Get away!
I would recommend a black one for wringing coffee out because the white one would be instant ruination. But no, honestly, I kid you not. If you're not going to do that, the one thing I don't sell the ears of a cat, and I've drunk coffee from the ears of a cat many times. The cat hates it, you end up injured, but if you turn a cat's ear upside down, it is a drinking receptacle.
I can't cope. I can't cope with this level of strangeness. Like, I've got a terrible hangover and I'm struggling as it is, to be honest. You know, I'm not really drinking at the moment. Well, I'm not. I'm generally not drinking booze. And last night I did drink booze and...
Has the hammer fallen?
The results speak for themselves. My head hurts and I feel a bit queasy, and I thought I would fix this by going for a run.
You're already hydrated, which is why your head feels like it's a shrunken raisin. And then you're going to go for a run and then lose any moisture that you had.
The only way,
I mean, I'm because of the time of year, I'm pretty sure it's not going to have been a hot morning, but I've done exactly that a few times to try and remedy the wrongs. And I've done it on like a hot summer's morning. Oh, it's hard.
I mean, I don't want to be one of those sort of evangelists for not drinking, because we all make our own choices, but I have to say I'd forgotten the misery of having a hangover quite quickly.
It's bad. It's bad.
And how nice it is to wake up feeling fresh and not feeling fresh. And we've run out of painkillers as well. And my wife's equally crispy because homemade cocktails. She got up at 5 a.m. and ate a banana because she felt so rough. And I was like, that's not going to help. And she's like, you're the man who just went for a run, you dick. So
you two, you've just done things that no hungover people ever do. Woken up in the early hours for a banana.
I know. What? I've got a hangover. I know what I'll do. I'll join the percussion section of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Oh, wait, no, that's not a good idea. Why would you do that, you idiot?
I've got an idea. I'm really parched. So what I've done is I've got a hairdryer, opened my mouth, and I've switched it on.
Every so often,
now my mouth,
I just drop a little
lovely
bit of silica gel into the jet of the hairdryer and blow it down my throat.
My tongue is now a Dorito. It's wonderful. I really like it.
Yeah, just a spoonful of salt every 5 minutes. That's really helping.
Yeah, did you put a couple of tablespoons of salt into a bedside glass of water? Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yes. Oh, tepid salty water. If you feel like you maybe had a little bit too much strong drinking, when you go to bed, just pour yourself a glass of beef stock, and just leave that.
I have to say,
really quenching.
When you're really nastily hungover and you sort of have to close one eye in order to sort of function. You know, it's that bad. I haven't been there for a little while. It was probably New Year's Day 2 years ago. It was probably the last quite bad one. But it's that feeling of when, if you've ever been in a car where the oil light is flickering, And we're talking mostly like old knackers, you know, cheap cars that.
Well, so it's not on all the time. It just every so often it just lets you know.
That's right. It's usually hot in traffic, or if you go around a hard corner, and the oil light gives you that little wink to say you do know that I'm in a bad way, don't you? And you do know that you are punishing me. You're being a bit of a bastard, and you need to stop. I've had that. I've had mostly friends' cars, and I've gone, I've just noticed the oil light's come on, and they've just gone, nah, it's fine, it's fine. And you're thinking to yourself, it's not fine. It's like me emptying my body of a lot of blood and then just sellotaping up the wound and then going for a run. It's not going to work, is it?
It's like a woman I used to work with who essentially wrote off her old Peugeot 106 because it didn't have any oil in it. And the way she described it was she went, yes, that little oil can light had been on for a while. And then there was a noise. And the engine seized on the M1.
A while?
Yeah, a while.
What the hell is a while?
I dread to think. I mean, I started to suspect definitely months.
Seriously? I'd give that car the George Cross for bravery.
I know.
For soldiering on. My brother's, who obviously we spoke about him last time, who's a mechanic, with old cars, he said by the time the oil light comes on in an old car, you've pretty much knackered it.
Really?
Yeah. So he says if it comes on and you're driving at any great speed, you've got less than 5 seconds before it's definitely damaged itself.
Oh, dear.
But the thing is newer cars run on better quality oil, more elastic oil, more, you know, better viscosity range. And the tolerances were better. So actually, you can run. I mean, I've done it on Fifth Gear and and Max Power. We did it once where we ran cars on no oil to see what would happen. And you'd be surprised what they can cope with.
Well, that's General Motors Northstar V8 can run with no oil for some distance, can't it? Because it's, I guess, for all the reasons you're saying, mostly down to tolerances and shizzle. But it just deactivates one bank of its cylinders, and then
that's what I do when I have a hangover.
Deactivate one bank.
I one side of the brain stops working. It's exactly modern eco engine. It's like, I'm sorry, the side of the brain that involves adult thinking and
it's
sensible
it's
choices that doesn't work at the moment. I'm really sorry about that.
I apologize. My brain is effectively a V4 at the moment.
It is a V4.
That's what those eco V8s do, isn't it? They go to V4s. The Cadillac went to one bank and then alternated banks to keep itself sort of going.
But
eco V8 would go to V4 formation. So a bit lumpy, but ultimately okay if you're just cruising.
So hungover me, V4, until I've had some really soggy Marmite toast.
Ooh.
And some coffee with a really big spoonful of honey in it. And then suddenly the other bank might splutter in. I feel it'd be all right. Or you've pulled over and you've gone, I think this needs some super unleaded. I don't normally give it super unleaded, but I'm going to go 98 RON today.
Do you ever do that, though? Do you ever give a car a tank of super sort of as a special treat?
Oh, I do a fuel present. It's completely a fuel present. I've done fuel presents. I tend to do it mostly because a lot of old cars, so depending on the timing and things, it doesn't really matter. But for example, if I put super in the Dodge, it wouldn't care because it's used to running on like 12 RON and it already runs on 95. So
whiskey.
Well, yeah, exactly. Whereas Japanese stuff, you know, like the Figaro, and I do actually give it the odd super, and it's got to be placebo effect on a car like that, where it sort of goes, thanks very much for that. That's really kind of you. Ooh. Whereas, I have had cars in the past where it's definitely, and I'm sure you've had it, where you notice it's like, oh, yeah, come on then. Let's go a bit harder, shall we? Let's go for another round.
Or conversely, I used to have that smart Roadster Brabus, and that was supposed to be run on super. But you can't always get it, can you? It's just a bit of a pain, particularly back then. This was a few years ago. Some places it's very hard to get super. And I always felt like it didn't run as well on 95, that it was a bit grumpy.
Annoyed with you.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I'm sure it's purely psychological, Bobby, a bit like, oh no, I've angered it. It's having a strop now.
Yeah, some cars.
Some 98 in it, it'd be like, wee, yay.
Yeah, I mean, I know some race drivers and, you know, hot pedalling journalists who probably drive on the limit a lot more than we. They mm-hmm. they go, oh yeah, you know, it's definitely V Power, or yeah, it's definitely Tesco 99, or
yeah. I run their favoured 911 on Super all the time, and I don't know if that's just, I sort of feel like it's the right thing to do.
I bet your wife doesn't.
No, she does, because she's on strict instructions to do it, and she knows. But then I've told you this before, haven't I? She loves to wind me up. She'd be like, I'm on my way home, but I'll be a bit later because I've got to stop for diesel. And she'd be in the Porsche and I'd go, no, petrol. And she'd be like, yeah, I know, I'm just winding you up. But she'd get me every time.
I didn't know that. That's cool. I like
every
that.
Every time. She'd just... And then
sweet woman.
When we still had a diesel-powered family car, she'd be like, hey, anyway, I'm just going to stop for petrol. I'd be like, not petrol, remember? And she's like, yes, I know. Where were we? Oh, no, hang on, wait. We haven't finished some Plug-O-Rama, because you were telling me about those delicious mugs and T-shirts that you're selling. And I wondered, are there any other items of merchandise, and from where could I buy them?
If you go to the Late Break Show website, there's a link through to my merch stand, which is Car it's Pervert just, Stand. Yeah, it's just me at the side of the road with
a lay-by on the table. A1.
I do burgers as well, really horrible ones. but it's mostly coffee mugs, caps, organic cotton T-shirts and hoodies. But keep tuned, folks, because on the run to Christmas there might be some other types of merch. In fact, Richard, can I ask you? I heard a rumour about you selling peddling new wares. Can you inform me?
Why, that's remarkable. You should bring this up, Johnny, because this very day my new book has gone on sale.
Is it today?
Well, assuming people are listening to this podcast the day it comes out, then yes. But I mean, if they're not,
I feel like
if someone's listening to this in like 2025, then it's all good. Yeah. Anyway, assuming this is Monday the 30th of November, which is when this show goes live, it's also when my new book has come out. It's Boring Car Trivia Volume 2, which I've been threatening for a while, and it's finally done. and it's on sale exclusively through Amazon because it's done through there. Self-publishing platform. It's available as a paperback or an ebook. I think it's nicer as a paperback for various reasons.
If I bought the paperback version, would you be able to write something intimate in the first page for me?
I've already printed something intimate in the front of every edition, so
okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I'll sign your copy next time.
Thanks for the preferential treatment, Rich.
So anyway, so just it's a load of a load of really arcane car facts all crammed together in a slender volume. This one, people might have bought the previous one. I hope they did, because...
they should have.
I mentioned it enough on this show. The medium-sized book of Boring Car Trivia was the first one, and that had sections in it. So there was a general section, and then there was a design section and a media section, stuff like that. I've binned off the sections for the second one. It's just a mad grab bag of stuff. You never know what's coming next. And what that means is... the book is the same size as the first one, but without any section dividers and stuff, I've crammed in more facts. So it's
I love these little nuggets, and I believe I really enjoy the cover, because you put a screenshot of the cover of it.
I was a bit worried. I wanted the cover to be quite boring, and I was a bit worried that it was too boring, and then I started to worry it wasn't boring enough.
You idiot. No,
I wanted it to look like a car manual. I wanted it to look like a sort of manual from a glove box of an old car, and I don't... And
it does.
We were talking the other day about Cooper, the typeface Cooper, which is very sort of redolent of the 60s or 70s. And I've used that because I think it's just a really solid retro typeface, and you can't go wrong with it. And I spent frigging ages trying to do a whole different cover, which I wanted to look like an 80s car brochure, like one of those sort of, you know, Ford and Austin Rover and people used to do brochures of their whole range.
Aspirational people doing things.
Yeah, well, they often just sort of, they'd have like maybe sort of the car, but slightly cropped. So it was just like the front three quarter of it or something on the front.
Next to a statue.
Nicely lit studio shot, but it was supposed to look like it had sky behind it or something. And I spent ages trying to mock up one of those and creating a generic looking 80s car in Photoshop. And
then what happened?
I just decided it was shit, so I stopped and I did the one, the cover that it has, in about 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. Well,
wish Axl Rose had taken a leaf out of your book.
Yeah.
With Chinese Revolution.
Or the Stone Roses. Second album, lads, let's just fucking do it. So the cover, for people who haven't seen it, it's got a line drawing of a car dashboard on it. And
I like it. I like it a lot.
It was based on a real drawing, but then I've monkeyed with it. So it's supposed to be generic. It's not supposed to look like any specific car. But I realised that this book is going to appeal to car nerds, and they're going to spot quite quickly the shape of the dashboard. They'll recognise what it is. So I've put a sort of Easter egg on the front that acknowledges, for people who spot it, what the basic dashboard template was taken from, even though, if you're a proper nerd, you'll also spot that all the controls are not accurate.
You've gone in deep, and I
know,
appreciate
I really
that.
Have. Sorry.
I've also love the fact the foreword is done by Jeremy Clarkson.
Oh, yeah, I should have mentioned that earlier, shouldn't I? It's probably a better selling point.
That's quite a good plug for that.
Yes, Jeremy has written me a short foreword for it, very kindly, because the last one had a foreword by James May, so I thought, well, I'll ask Jeremy this time. And as someone on Twitter pointed out last week, I need to do a third volume now so I can ask Richard Hammond to do the intro.
I was going to say, if you do a fourth book, you got my number, mate, all right?
That's a good point, actually. I should have asked you first, because then...
No, it's okay. I think you've got more history with Clarkson, May, Hammond than I. And I'm cool with that. Do you know, we were supposed to do this podcast all about questions from listeners, and we're what, 15 minutes in and we haven't done any yet? We should probably do that, shouldn't we? No, 17 minutes in or something like that.
I know I read out some readers' emails last week, and people seem to like that. Well, you seem to like that, certainly, and I think a few people maybe might. I don't know what's going on. I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Broken my brain. It's very much running on three at the moment. So,
what about if it was a three-cylinder, though? Then it'd be absolutely fine.
Yeah, but...
But it's not, is it?
It's not, no. So...
What engine is your brain?
I don't know.
What engine would your brain be?
I mean, sometimes it works quite well, but...
Is it a smooth brain, or is it a bit lumpy?
Oh, it's a little bit lumpy sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, mine is, sadly. I'd love it to be a really nice straight six, but I don't think it is.
No. It's on that note, we've had quite a lot of good messages picking up on the thing we were talking about last week, singers as car engines, or vice versa. Which I'll get to in a minute, because I'm going to have to find some of them. But
talk to me, Tony Tibbs.
An email from Ashley James. Hello, Ashley, who says, "Hi, chaps. Just a quick question. On your most recent podcast episode, you were mentioning the TV series The Crine." He spelled it correctly, C-R-I-N-E. But he's put the crown in brackets after it, just in case. I just wanted to ask if I was correct in thinking that most of the on-road driving scenes were filmed at Millbrook. And the answer is no, they weren't. For anyone who's seen The Crine, you might have noticed that quite regularly, in almost every episode, there's a bit where the royals are sort of driving somewhere or being driven. And they always go down this sort of quite swooping, very wide section of road that doesn't quite look right. And it's the Chobham test track.
Which is now called Longcross, isn't it?
Now called Longcross, yes, which is an old army testing place that it's... auto car go there a lot, don't they? And I've filmed things there. I know you've filmed things there.
Back in the magazine days, used to do a lot of still photography there, pre-social media, etc. When I was on car, we used to use it, and... But this was before it got used as a studio. It's now quite a big TV, movie film studio.
Yeah, and they do. They've done some of the recent Star Wars stuff there, haven't they?
Yeah, they've done weird stuff. They've done Marvel films. They've done Pirates of the Caribbean bits. They've done some mad shit there. But
it's right by the M25, isn't it?
I know.
You sort of wouldn't know it's there unless you know.
It's really close to Cobham. isn't it Cobham, the name of the... there's Cobham and Chobham, basically
it's Surrey,
leafy
isn't it?
Surrey.
Yeah, yeah.
Leafy Surrey, lovely.
Leafy, so frigging leafy.
And when I used to go there, when it wasn't used as a film studio, it was like an abandoned military village that used to be top secret for tank testing. And there were some sort of creepy buildings there which had biohazard signs outside. And there was one, I remember one that was like hot weather or extreme weather testing, extreme condition temperature testing, do not go in, lots of big signs. And there was always two dead palm trees outside. I remember looking at the palm trees going, is that like a hint to a hot weather testing? Let's plant two palm trees. Oh, by the way, they won't survive because it's England. Oh, okay.
It wasn't like Thunderbirds where they folded down to allow things to go in and out.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because there was a feeling of sort of Thunderbirds about it, kind of downtrodden British Thunderbirds. And I did see... I did
now on BBC Two, downtrodden British Thunderbirds.
Well, you know, it's like the Ford Thunderbird was America's thing, and we had the what? The Ford Console? Cresta was never quite the Thunderbird, was it? I mean, it was our Americanized thing of the 50s. But going back, while the photographer was doing pretty still shots of whatever car we had to shoot there, I would always sneak off because I knew I had a half an hour to waste. And there were some really mad buildings and some basements where I think they used to do blast testing and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And this was pre-camera phones, pre-torches on a phone or anything like that. So if you didn't have a torch, you were just very much in the dark. And I remember going down a flight of steps. I remember going down a flight of stairs and into pitch dark, and there was no electrics live in any of these army houses or buildings. And I quickly realised that the steps went down and down and down and down, like five houses depth. So creepy, creepy deep.
Yeah.
And I got the heebie-jeebies after about, I don't know, 100 steps of just clutching this handrail. And I was like, I don't know what's down here. It's all ex-Cold War shizzle. I'm not going down here. But I remember going into the tank. In fact, hold on a minute. Let me take my headphones off, because I think I stole something from there. Hang on.
You think you stole?
Yeah. There's a sign on the door of my office that says, keep out, trial in progress, trials personnel only. And I'm going to put my headphones back on so I can hear you. I stole that sign from there. I remember stealing it. If they're listening, I didn't steal it. I bought it. You can have it back. Yeah. I'm sure it's different owners now, so who cares? But yeah.
But no, the track, the Long Cross track, is quite a weird, not very long track, is it? I don't know, I couldn't tell you how long it is. I'm bad at estimating distances, but I'm going to say 1,000 miles. No, 1 mile. Maybe somewhere between. It's probably about 2 miles. I honestly don't know. It's not very long at all.
I think it's not even 2 miles.
And it goes
round
and it's sort of, and it's a bit uppy-downy, and it's got some actually quite tight corners on it, and it goes through the trees. And it's not, there's no runoff particularly, is there? So it's sort of, it's not a good speed lapping track.
It's typical of these sorts of kind of let's make it look like a normal road in Britain.
Yeah.
If you're pressing on these, and I remember once having a moment, luckily rescuing it, you realise there's no runoff and there's lots of mature trees, which are the enemy of a car, right? Like trees don't give, as we know from World Rally. You've got to be a really handy driver because you do not want to end up above 100 miles an hour in a cluster of oak trees. It's not cool. And actually, I remember that one of the last times I was there, we were filming something with a drone pilot, and the drone pilot was chasing this car that I was in, trying to get this shot, and just totally got it wrong and went flat out into the trees. And I just heard the shattering of plastic over the walkie-talkie. Just go, so the drone didn't follow me then. No, the drone didn't see that there were some overhanging tree branches and just went VMAX into them. Got a confetti of carbon fibre.
So you do, you see the Long Cross. If you've ever been there, you just know it when you see it. It's used on TV and in adverts quite a bit, and it just doesn't look quite right somehow. It's It's like sparse. The road's sort of it's a bit too wide, I think, is part of it. They've put road markings on one bit of it, and it's just a bit too wide.
Yeah.
There's not enough street furniture, and
there's no McDonald's litter, unfortunately.
There's no litter, and it just doesn't. It's almost, but not quite. It's the same as that place that's now been sold and redeveloped, but the Transport Research Laboratory, or Transport and Road Research Laboratory in Crowthorne in Berkshire, which used to have.
Sorry, I've just burped. If you heard that on the mic, I'm really sorry.
Burp last week? Or was me? Anyway.
It's just too much air inside the
Britain's
bag.
Britain's leading source of car chat and burps, Smith and Sniff. There's a reason we're frequently number one in the podcast chart, and it's not the burps.
I still can't. I still can't believe that, but I'm very, very thankful for it.
Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah, no, TRRL had a road network inside their sort of high-speed, not-quite bowl that was all through woods, and it was sort of looked like kind of B-roads going through woodland. And you saw stuff on TV that was filmed there. And again, didn't look quite right, just something a bit creepy about it and off and not realistic. And I think it's they had too much road furniture, because they used to test out new styles of crash barrier and traffic lights and mini roundabout and all sorts. So everything was a bit too pristine and a bit over-decorated, and it just sort of looked a bit wrong.
In the last series of Fifth Gear, I think it was, I went to Korea, and we did a couple of features in Korea, which was really exciting. One of them was where we went to, I think they call it the Autonomous Village, where Kia and Hyundai testing out fully autonomous cars without human intervention. Or there is human intervention, but it's in other cars.
Yeah.
And I was being driven around by an autonomous car, and this village is not really a village. It's loads of really hastily put up buildings with vinyl wraps across the front. So there's pretend shops and pretend houses and intersections, crossroads and things, and street markings and pedestrian crossings, but it's not really real, because you feel like you're in a modern spaghetti western with with pretend mobile phone stores and florists and stuff. I find it hilarious. I wasn't really allowed to take any photos in there because it's kind of top secret, but I did take a couple. And also I realized I had to run away from the crew and these important people from Kia, because I thought I just need the toilet. And then I realised that there wasn't a toilet. So I thought I'd just run around the corner and have a sort of a wee down a side alley. But there isn't a side alley because it's a pretend village and they're all vinyl wrap shop fronts. And I also noticed that every sort of five shops, they would repeat the vinyl wrap. So you go, hang on a minute, there was a jeans shop around the corner with the same front. It's because it's just a vinyl wrap, Johnny. You're being thick.
I thought you were going to say, you came back and said to the people from Kia, oh, sorry about that, I just popped off to use the loo. And they'd go, but there aren't any lavatories around here. Oh, sorry.
No.
You're
going
to have
sticker.
To change that vinyl wrap now.
There was a bit of that. There was a bit of that. It was also, I think I've told this to you in the past before. I was in an autonomous car that wasn't quite working properly, and the test driver from Kia who couldn't speak English and I couldn't speak Korean, unfortunately. He was in the driver's seat and I was in the passenger seat, and we were waiting for the film crew to say, set, we're ready, on the walkie-talkie, and I was so tired I actually fell asleep next to him. And then I got woken up with the walkie-talkie and went, okay, action, guys. And I was fully asleep. It's quite... Actually, thinking about it, it was quite rude. I was bloody tired.
Yeah. Mind you, a mate of mine once got a minicab at sort of like 5 a.m. or something to have to go to the airport. And he was kind of dozing in the back of this Prius and stopped at some traffic lights. And he was sort of drifting in and out of sleep because he was really knackered. And then he sort of half awake, became dimly aware that there was somebody snoring, and it was the driver of his taxi.
The driver?
At some traffic lights, which were now on green, and the driver had nodded off at the lights, and my mate had to poke him awake.
Oh, my gosh.
Would you mind driving the car now, please? And then he said he very much did not sleep for the rest of the journey, because he's thinking, this bloke is... He's going to fall asleep while we're moving.
Well, if he's an Uber, do you not give feedback? You go, driver was nice, but asleep.
But asleep, yes. Driver snored a little bit, but otherwise great. I was going to say, talking as you were about some Chobham / Longcross and spooky Cold War stuff, it just reminded me of one of the most interesting places that I've ever been in the course of filming. Years ago, we did a Top Gear item about communist cars, and we gathered together loads of sort of Soviet-era cars from all across Eastern Europe and Russia to see if any of them were actually any good. And we were looking for a location, and I can't remember where we wanted to film it originally, and it was just we were struggling a bit, and we wanted somewhere a bit interesting, and I suddenly remembered that Greenham Common Air Base, which I think is in Berkshire, is still sort of exists, like the runway, which was one of the longest runways in Britain, Europe. It was really big because I think they want to drop B-52s and stuff onto it, and has now been all dug up.
Love Shack, obviously.
Yes. It's a little known place.
Yes.
The runway has all been dug up and returned to common land, which is what it was before the airbase was built there. But the old sort of bunker things where they used to keep the nuclear missiles, and a lot of the sort of the old buildings of the base have declared a heritage site or something. And so they're all fenced off, so you can't just wander in. We had to book the place and pay for it, and someone let us in. But it's all still there. These, you know, those sort of, they're like little mounds, and they've got grass on top of them, but then actually they've got these huge hydraulic blast doors that open up, and they stored big, scary missiles in there. But then behind that, sort of lower down, there were all these old buildings that were just you know, sort of offices and things, and some of them, like you were talking about, had like kind of undergroundy bits and stuff,
biohazard stickers.
Yeah,
and
you just go and poke around it. It was really interesting and a bit spooky.
I love doing any. That's why I love still trawling around abandoned cars and, you know, fields with a load of crap dereliction in, which hopefully in 2021, Rich, we might be able to do a bit more of that. I quite enjoy it. And there's nothing more pleasurable than a walk where you stumble across a broken old car or van. I find it deeply enjoyable. It's my idea of golf. I mean, some people say golf is wonderful walk spoiled with
good
a
walk
ball.
Sport, yeah, something like that, yeah.
And that's my idea of a perfect walk, and I've got a couple of
a good
of
walk enhanced.
Walks. Yeah, it is.
By finding
it
absolutely. Hey, on that note, we always talk about we want to do CSI tarpaulin, where you and me just sort of wander around looking at cars that are under tarps on people's driveways and trying to identify them and things.
Netflix, you've got our numbers. Yep.
I've had a bit of a CSI tarpaulin satisfactory breakthrough this week.
Okay.
There's a house that I walk past sometimes that's got a car under a tarp on the drive, and it's been really bugging me what it is. I just could not figure it out. And it's quite a long drive, so the car's a little bit far away, as much as it's probably sort of like two car lengths back up against the garage door under a tarpaulin. I couldn't figure out
if
there were other things on top of the car. The tarpaulin seemed a strange shape. And
this is like the Christmas tray game that my mum insists we do every Christmas.
Oh, what? We have to guess what's under
a tea towel.
Yeah,
you put mysterious things under a tea towel, and then you whip the tea towel off. You've got 30 seconds to guess what they all are. Then the tea towel goes back on, and you're allowed to carry on writing once the tea towel's gone back on. So I always try and memorise the height of all of the objects. So I go, oh, yeah, the high one, that's a hairbrush. And then that's, a Russian doll that's creepy. And that's whatever. Oh, that's the bottle of whiskey my dad hasn't ever drunk for 25 years because he doesn't like whiskey. And, yeah, but it's kind of like that, I think.
Well, great news for me, anyway, because I've got some satisfaction in this. The tarpaulin it seems to have blown off a little bit and revealed underneath what appears to be a Ford Capri.
Oh!
With no glass.
And
I was thinking, going, that's ruined. That is ruined. What are you doing? Why are you cluttering up your driveway with this? And it's led me to think that the sister show of CSI Tarpaulin should just be called Scrap It. And it's almost like an intervention show where you and I just go around people who have got these ill-fated projects, in inverted commas, under tarpaulins on the driver. One day I'll get around to fixing it up. No, you won't. And anyway, it's not that interesting a car. Just throw it away. Come on, we're going to go with you to the scrapyard and we're going to throw it away and we'll give you £10.
Is that not like, that's a bit like what my friend Dan's 50 quid or fuck off car buying tactic, which is just very one dimensional, unfortunately.
Or James May wanted to do a show, and I think he was quite serious about this, called Antiques Bonfire. And it was like Antiques Roadshow, except people brought along sort of old wooden furniture and he would look at it and go, actually, you know, that's not interesting or worth money. On the bonfire it goes. On the basis that there's too much old tat in the world and it needs sorting out.
I'd quite like... There is something quite... there is something very mentally healthy about ridding yourself of hoarding. And I definitely come from a family where that's an issue. But... At the same time, I like the idea of the sort of re-gifting. So windowless Capri might be rotten to the core, but windowless Capri might be a really fine donor to, I don't know, another Capri person. Now, obviously, you could see that as handing a problem on to another person. But at the same time, some people are very proactive. I've sold cars that I've never done anything with to people, and within 2 weeks of selling it, they've sent me pictures going, oh, yeah, I've already prepped it and repainted it. And you're like, what?
Oh.
Wow. You've done more in the last week than has been done to that car in 30 years. That's brilliant.
Also, just the John Peel band name Klaxon went off there. Tonight, in session, we've got three tracks from Windowless Capri.
I'd love to hear Windowless Capri.
Windowless Capri.
What sort of music would they do?
For some reason, I can't get past seeing them as a sort of 80s, kind of like the Style Council.
See, I always thought the Style Council were better than the Jam.
What?
Yeah. The Jam were good. They weren't really... I mean, I was too young for the Jam the first time around, so I got to know Paul Weller through Paul Weller just calling himself Paul Weller and doing solo work. But, I think the Style Council are...
Council.
I think Long Hot Summer's probably just... I don't know, it's just brilliantly cool. There's nothing better than listening to Long Hot Summer by the Style Council driving a classic car on a hot day. It's wonderful. Preferably an 80s classic car. One day I'd like to listen to that song through some paper cone speakers of an Astra GTE convertible just for shits and giggles.
Well, yeah,
with an Ermshire body, an awkward Ermshire body kit that's clearly only been made with a set square.
Can it have white wheel trims? Not alloys, wheel trims in white. Oh.
Yeah, what about the windscreen wiper covers? Those white sleeves that clip over.
Sleeves. Just awful. Look, we have said we were going to do some listeners' emails, and we've done one so far.
We're absolutely.
I was just going to read this one quickly from Alex Mills, which is on a similar theme. He said, "We're listening to the recent podcast when he discussed the Crown. I think he means the Crine. Generally, they're good at car selection. However, in the first season, set in the early 50s, they had a scene with a Series 2 Land Rover, and it should have been a Series 1. Well spotted. Also, they have a Paris-Dakar scene in the recent series of the Peugeot 504 with fake V8 sounds dubbed over the top, which is poor. Yes, that was a bit odd. But he also gets on, in the latest Crown episode, you see them drive a lot on a private road at, I think, Bedford Autodrome. Well, see previous answer, Alex. It's Longcross / Chobham in Surrey is where it is. You normally see this filming location when a drama has a car crash scene, as it's probably easier than doing a car crash on an actual road. Yes, good point.
But it's not easier, it's just safer.
Safer, yeah. It's very...
It's not hard to crash a car.
People get a bit funny about you. Have you
ever intentionally crashed a car? You have on TV shows.
I have not personally intentionally crashed a car, but I have been around when it has been done a few times. You're suddenly reminded of the kinetic energy involved.
The sound is interesting.
Yeah, the sound is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen... You have seen a real crash test, like a laboratory against a wall, NCAP-style crash test.
Oh, yeah, I've witnessed NCAP crashing several times. Volvo's Range Rover Velar, just before it was actually... launched, I was there for the NCAP test of it, and
someone told me that it makes an extraordinary noise.
Oh, it's real, and because it's mostly indoors, some of them are done outdoors, but indoors, yeah, it's incredible. I've watched numerous ones. I've watched the Volvo XC90, the new one, the one that's current now, where they did the gully strike, which is one of the most brutal crashes, control crashes.
Did you do that for fifth gear?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen you doing that. Yes, they drive into a ditch, don't they? It's really mad.
Yeah, in fact, to prove it, it's not actual proof, really, because you can't see what I'm doing. But I do have on the windowsill of my office a chunk of the alloy wheel that shattered on that XC90 gully strike. The guy, the Swedish gentleman, said, yeah, you can take that. So I actually had the alloy wheel of a car that hadn't even gone into production yet. So strictly speaking, I'd stolen some unsold car parts. But yeah, I'm saying that and I can't find it. I'm now...
It's okay. No one can see.
I feel like I want to prove it.
No, stop. I've got another email for you. You need to pay attention. Roger Benest says, hello, gentlemen. Greetings from cold and snowy Edmonton, Canada. Hello, Roger.
I was only talking to my wife about Canada yesterday. Never been. And really want to go.
Oh, it's great. If someone said, I'm afraid you can't be British anymore, you must be another nationality, I think I'd just go, oh, Canadian then. I think it looks great being Canadian.
I think it seems appealing.
It's like get a lot of that kind of jazzy beatiness of being American, but without the awfulness. And it's like, I've rephrased that, particularly considering my wife's American.
Without
the brashness, without the sort
Your children are half American.
I know.
Basically.
I know, they are. I realised that, because we always have this sort of ongoing battle of words and the pronunciation of words in our house. And. I realise I've lost the war on, or certainly lost the battle on how vitamin is pronounced, because our kids say vitamin.
Your children don't say vitamins.
They do. Only because my wife's better at remembering to give them vitamins. And so she's the one who says the word more often, so she's won that one. But anyway, Roger Bennis says, a pertinent question
for
you.
Richard.
Do you have any memorable, brackets, hair-raising experiences driving in extreme cold or snow?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of them was the Vectra VXR that I told you the story about, where my friend had to go for a roadside poo. That was a while ago now. So there's that one. So that was fairly hair raising because it was quite snowy for the UK and the car was ill suited to the job. I got caught in quite a bad snowstorm once driving a VW Beetle show car, and again massively ill-equipped for the job. I mean, the Beetle's a good car in snow, but this one had Porsche at the time. The Porsche Boxster had just been released or not long released, and had Boxster wheels and tires on it and quite a heavily modified engine. That was a bit of a bottom twitcher. It was freezing fog too, so it made it very tricky. because the demisters weren't working. I was driving it in skiing gloves, so that was quite hardcore. I know. Where I live, the road directly outside my house is not gritted, and we get some. When we get snow, it's just left. And although we don't, in the UK, snow doesn't stay on the ground for long, it's one time it stayed on the ground for maybe a fortnight. And I was out in my Honda Insight at the time, which has, I don't know, the tyres are about an inch thick because it's an eco car. I went down the road in it, and it behaves really nicely, the Insight. It's obviously quite a light car. But it was that sickening feeling of I went into a corner and nothing happened on the steering seemed like 12 seconds. And I did the worst thing possible, and I added another input, which it's like a boat, apparently. When you change the rudder position and then you change it again, it remembers and it goes, oh, no, you did that position. I'm going to do that and then I'll do the other position.
Yeah, like pushing various buttons on a locked up computer and then it freezes itself and goes, you wanted to type U 17 times and then return.
exactly,
and then switch the web browser. Okay.
That's exactly it. And I did that and I got into this awful little slapper in the Honda Insight. And the worst thing was, as I was trying to climb out of this sort of snowy slapper, coming the other way, I noticed was a car doing the same thing.
Oh.
And it was only, it was all only at about 30 miles an hour, but 30 on snow when you don't have snow tyres is actually quite awful. And I noticed we both were trying to correct and then correct and then correct. And I thought, we're going to either both end up in the ditch or we're both going to hit one another. And we ended up not doing either. It was remarkable. But when I drove back about 2 hours later after where I'd been, I looked at the tyre tracks of both the cars. It was hilarious. You just went, oh, there's a crash. No, it isn't. There's a crash. No, there isn't. There's a crash. No, there isn't.
I did that once. When I had that Jag XJR, I was driving home across London on main roads, and it was snowing quite heavily, but, you know, sort of main roads are trafficked enough that it was keeping it sort of clear. But then I wasn't really concentrating that, and I just instinctively took a little shortcut down a back street that I always took.
Oh, yeah.
And it was thick with undisturbed snow.
That's rare in London.
Really cold. Really, I know, it's weird. I think it's fallen heavily and quickly, and I just got into a where there was no control. It was like, oh, not like the steering is not doing steering anymore. And I kind of just eased off.
You were half asleep, and you had
and I was
caught
like,
you
just,
out.
This is, if I keep going down here, I'm going to crash. And there were no other cars around, but there were parked cars either side of it, and it was quite a narrow road. And I was like, screw it, there's a driveway there. I'm going to turn around. That's the safest thing to do. Go back to the main road and just head home on main roads.
What?
And in the course of turning around, I backed into this driveway, which is slightly uphill, and then the car just started slithering down into the roads and straight towards a parked car. And I just thought, I had time. There's a thing about accidents on snow and ice, isn't it? Often they happen so slowly, you've got time to sort of think, well, I'm now going to damage my car. And I had time to think, I'm going to have an accident. It's going to do some damage to my car and someone else's car. Right, well, I suppose I better ring the insurance company.
How am I going to react to this?
Yeah, no, I think I'd gone through all the stages of sort of anger, acceptance, loss, whatever it was. I was just, by the time it then... Because I was also like, don't input. I'd remembered, just hands and feet off things, because you're only going to make it worse. But I think I had a slight bit of steering lock on, and it slithered. And this is all happening at like 2 miles an hour tops. It slithered, and it slithered just behind this parked car, and there was a gap. And I was like, I'm not going to hit the parked car. Oh, but now I'm going to hit the curb and it's going to knock my fucking tracking off or something. Well, okay, that's what's going to happen now. And again, through all the acceptance of that... And then, amazingly, it just sort of, like a wedge of snow, I think, built up in front of the wheels. And it came to a halt.
What, really softly?
Really softly. It just stopped. And I remember just sitting there for ages, just going, I'm alive. The car's alive. There's no damage. And then I managed to, it took fucking forever, and there was a lot of wheel spin, but I managed to extract it without bumping into anything.
That is the walk of shame, but in a car, isn't it? Trying to get off someone's drive.
Oh, man.
And the auto box is like selecting last gear.
Yes. I think we're in top. Why is the speedo showing 57 miles an hour?
You're making such a sheen on the snow from going nowhere.
Oh, it's all horrible. Roger, thank you for your email. I don't know how you cope. Well, I know how people in Canada cope the same way people in Scandinavia do, because they get on with it.
I don't want to use up the rest of it. Well, tell you what, we'll do snow driving in another episode, because I've realised there's a couple more stories. There was one where that had that epic battle to get to Heathrow one day when Britain had its worst snowfall in years, and I had a what then was the brand new Jag XF on 20s.
Yeah,
and lovely car though it was a snow challenge of a day. It took me a full day to get to Heathrow. It was proper Trains, Planes and Automobiles spec. I remember it being a lot of fun looking back. But
we had quite a lot of messages about some singers as car engines. There's one here from Rob Gordon who says, I'm currently nailed to my desk. Florence the Machine have just turned up on a Spotify playlist, having been watching far too many old rallies on the Splendid VHS Rallies YouTube channel.
Oh,
occurs to me that she could also be likened to the rotary-powered Mazda RX-7 rally monster from the late 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Very good, yes.
Yeah, Florence's
machine is a wankle. With an alarmingly light flywheel, the rapid blips up and down the rev range and the screaming to the red line are not entirely dissimilar to the renditions of the said Miss F. Not necessarily the most tuneful output, but very exciting nonetheless. Yeah, good call, Rob. Very good. He's also said Chris Isaac could be an old Merc R109-300SL with gentle mumblings in the low rev range and slurred changes. You don't seem to get very far, but the journey is quite pleasant.
It's
the occasional hard prod of the accelerator gets Chris up to the higher end of the rev range, but he's generally much happier sub 3K.
Well, that wins for me. Just on the detailed description of the Chris Isaac based straight six Mercedes, which is it's smooth, but ultimately not a great driving vehicle in terms of performance.
Yeah,
I love that. I love Florence. Florence is totally a wankel.
Yeah. That's
great. I love that.
Oh, isn't it? There were loads of them on the YouTube channel as well, because we put these podcasts up on YouTube. They're audio only. You don't get any video or anything like that. But people seem to still listen to them that way. And there are comments. In fact, someone said last week that they listen to the podcast through a podcast player, but then go onto the YouTube channel to read and add to the comments. So that's interesting. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Bloody hell,
there's a comment from a guy called Tom Lanigan, which I absolutely loved, which is about, because we were talking about the madness of car owners clubs the other week, and
yes, that's definitely your next book.
He's written one about, he bought he said back in the day when it was a straight financial choice between an immaculate 911 3.2 Carrera or a similar condition 928 S2, I bought the 928. I attended a Porsche Owners Club event at Brands Hatch. Nobody would speak to the 914 owners. The air-cooled owners wouldn't speak to the water-cooled owners. The air-cooled RS owners wouldn't talk to the Carrera owners. The air-cooled RS lightweight owners wouldn't talk to the RS touring owners. And
what?
One Porsche owner had decided to bring another car from his collection, a Ferrari 512 BB. He had the two clamshells raised and was happily talking to a few of us. Most others stayed inside, showing no interest at all.
What?
That's brilliant.
Did you say
I decided one event
in...
was enough for me. Club members are a strange group. Thank you, Tom. That's very funny.
So you're supposed to be bringing a community together through mutual appreciation of the same mark, but that's not the case.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's... Wow. Okay.
I know I was going to do Singers and Legends, but I love some of these comments. Bispal, someone called themselves Bispal, has said, regarding Prince Charles's Granada, I've heard he really liked them and always bought them in gear trim, but insisted on the GL seats as he preferred them. A friend of a friend who knew Charles bought a Granada gear as Charles recommended one. Is this a real
story? Is this true? I sincerely hope this is true.
Would you really recommend the Ford Granada, Your Highness? Yes. However, when he... So the friend of a friend asked for GL seats too and was told it wasn't possible and his request could not be accommodated, to which he replied, you did it for my friend, which was met with, we didn't. Who's your friend who claims to have them? Prince Charles, he replied. He got his GL seats.
He got the GL, seriously?
Yeah.
So just when we think somebody's just retrofitted seats from a scrapyard, it's actually a dealer fit.
Do you know who else gets some off-menu seats put in their car? Is Paul McCartney. Because in recent years, Paul McCartney's been driven around in a Lexus LS, but he's obviously a very committed vegetarian and he doesn't want leather seats. So Lexus UK specially have him made a UK spec LS, but with the cloth seats that you can usually only get in Japan.
That's wonderful.
So if you ever see a Lexus LS, a recent shape Lexus LS at an auction or a dealer, and it's got cloth seats and you think this doesn't seem right, you are probably buying one of Paul McCartney's old cars.
That's really cool. I hope that's in your book or
not. It's not. God damn it.
Well, you idiot. Just rip them all up and start again.
Yeah, that's it. If you've bought one today, as soon as you heard this podcast, send it to me and I'll write it in Biro. Or just wait till volume 3, which seems inevitable will happen one day, probably not for a while. Look, we should wrap things up, but first of all, I just want to do some things. Barry White, Viper V10, says Alistair Niche.
Viper V10. That is actually. But is it always on
idle? They're a bit lumpy, aren't they? Barry White's quite smooth at the top end, and I don't know that Vipers are.
Well, what's really... I'm wondering whether Barry White would be a clattery Cummins diesel.
No, he's smooth.
He's smooth. Sorry, I just take that right back. Sorry, I'm trying to think of a very low revving but smooth big engine, because it's got to be a big engine. Like, Barry White was a bit of a unit.
I mean, one of those like cargo ship engines that's got each piston's like 12 feet across.
Oh yeah, like submarine.
They sort of like 2 RPM, but I don't know how smooth they are.
No, I don't.
Romp.
What about the Scania? The Scania.
Maybe some truck stuff. Chris the Snail Driver on YouTube says, David Byrne, definitely an Austin Metro automatic going up and down a few hills.
So now this is more gearbox specific, isn't it? Because it's a perfectly okay engine, but it's mated to a dismal box.
Yeah. So, Oliver Braithwaite says, Noddy Holder and a BDA certainly share the same 70s induction roar. That's good, yes.
That's very good. Noddy Holder is a BDA.
Baby, really,
that's brilliant. Love that.
Yeah, these are good. These are great. I really enjoy these. I'll do one more, and then we really should stop.
Well, tell you what, we can always carry these on because I mean I'm enjoying them. I don't know if
I have a feeling that okay. The final one, just this because this made me chuckle. Jason Arthur's on YouTube says Mark E. Smith of the Fall is definitely a very poorly Honda Melody.
A melody. That's a scooter. That's the scooter, isn't it?
Pharmacist. Yeah.
That's really good.
I mean, Marky Smith, I don't even... That's as good as I can think of for Marky Smith. He has a distinctive voice, definitely.
It's a damaged moped.
Okay, this is the Fall. And after that, more from Damaged Moped.
Make me laugh. This does. I've definitely drunk too much coffee.
This has been a strange and significant milestone in the recovery of my from my hangover. But anyway,
are you all right? Are you free from the shackles?
I'm feeling
a bit
better now. Yeah, probably if I go and have some lunch and something, I could. Yeah, I might be all right. Anyway, look. Thank you ever so much for listening. Thank you for your emails, smithandsniff@gmail.com, or leave a comment on the YouTube page. We do read all of them, and one day we'll try and read out more than like two in one episode when we're claiming that we're going to go through a load of emails. Sorry, we got a bit sidetracked as usual. Anyway, I have three things to tell you. Number one, Johnny has a solo YouTube channel called The Late Break Show. It's got lots of excellent videos for your delight, including a wonderful look at his wife's Nissan Figaro, which is went up last week. Also, don't forget there is Late Break Show /Car Pervert merch to be bought with Christmas coming up and all that. Speaking of which, number two, second thing I have to tell you is I have a new book out today. Yay! It's called Boring Car Trivia Volume 2 by Sniff Petrol. It's available exclusively on Amazon as a paperback or an ebook. It's full of very, very obscure and quite dull bits of information about cars. If you ever wondered what they were going to call the Land Rover Defender and then thought better of it, that's in there. Do you want to know who designed the FSO Polonaise? It might surprise you. That's in there too.
Les Dennis.
Buy the book to find out. Oh, God, you're giving it away.
Sorry.
Idiot.
Spoiler alert.
The third thing I have to tell you is that Manchester Acid House classic Voodoo Ray by a guy called Gerald was based around a sample of Peter Cook shouting Voodoo Rage. But a guy called Gerald's sampler couldn't accommodate all of the clip and cut it off.
Seriously?
Ray. And that is how the song got its name.
That's brilliant.
See, I'm not just about boring.
I love that track as well.
Boring music track. It's great, isn't it? I was just.
It's a really, really good chilled out.
Yeah, oh, it's fabulous. Well, that's what I was recommending.
So retrospective, you got me getting dewy eyed over early 90s dance now.
Yeah. So that's the end of this week's Smith and Sniff. We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, please go and buy my book. Please go and buy Johnny's merchandise. And then go and listen to Voodoo Ray by a guy called Gerald, because it's ace. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.